This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association and associate professor at the University of Southern California. My guest today is Dr. Christiana Wolf, trained physician in gynecology at the University Hospital in Berlin, Germany. Began studying meditation early in her career during medical school, then transitioned to becoming an MBSR teacher with the Inside LA program in Los Angeles. She is now an MBSR teacher trainer and the lead trainer for our Veterans Affairs National Mindfulness Facilitator Training. Her books include A Clinician's Guide to Teaching Mindfulness and a just recently released book titled Outsmart Your Pain, Mindfulness and Self-Compassion to Help You Leave Chronic Pain Behind. And this focuses on the use of mindfulness and compassion for chronic pain management. She can also be found running long distance, Christiana. So I assume you know pain.
Different pain, yes.
Different type of pain. So welcome, Dr. Wolf. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Very happy to be here.
Yeah. Wonderful. And you have this this head teacher trainer position, and this is rare, I think. And how do you become a head teacher trainer of mindfulness teachers, and how did you become on that path?
You know, it's interesting. The way that I see it, really, like, it's just like in a hospital setting, right? You start out as a trainee, and then you're in a physician, and then you become an attendant. And at some point, they will ask you to train other people, right? So in medicine, we have the saying is like, see one, do one, teach one. And in so in mindfulness, it's a little bit similar. And it's very different in the Buddhist tradition where I come from. So it's like this really interesting field between, like, this is what is needed, this is what you do, and you just teach. And so for me, it was really, when I was still working at the university, I actually really loved teaching medical students. I did that for years. I think I was really good at that. And when I transitioned to become an MBSR teacher, I didn't really think about teaching, because that was just something I was exploring. I was learning to do myself. And then over time, it was just something that then people said, like, we need somebody here. That's usually how it starts. There's a need. People say, like, can you start with that? And then you start, and then you do hopefully a good job, and then you're invited back. So that is kind of how that worked with with MBSR. And eventually it did also work like that at the VA. But what was really interesting, how I first got into teaching, was because I was asked to teach by my teacher, right? And this is really different these days, because, right, we have like so many people who want to teach mindfulness, right? So they take an MBSR class or they take a mindfulness class and they fall in love and they go like, oh my God, I want to share that with my peeps, my population, my colleagues, whatever. And then they do a training and they start teaching. In the Buddhist tradition, that is unheard of, right? In the Buddhist tradition, it is really your teacher assesses. I mean, it's like more traditional, more hierarchical, right? But your teacher decides when you're ready to teach. So like we even joke to the point where, so like, if you ask to teach, that is a clear sign that you're not ready, right? And so it's this interesting thing is like that. And because I'm also a Buddhist teacher, and I wasn't really first interested in teaching. Because I had a profession. I was not thinking about becoming even like a mindfulness teacher or MBSR teacher. It was just something that at some point made sense.
That's a really good point. Can you tell me what year this was when you were transitioning into the teacher trainer role? Because this field has evolved in many ways. And to talk to your point about when people decide or how they will teach, it's been an important question. Like, how do we know someone should be teaching this? When are they ready? Do they embody the practice? Do they have their own practice? There's a lot of questions. I'm wondering when this was and what were like the requirements at the time beyond someone saying, hey, you really look like you have a skill here.
Right.
We need you.
Yeah, I think I started in 2010 or 2011 to train people. So it's been a while, and I had been really practicing for a really long time before that. Right. So, and that is like a constant question. So like first you teach and at some point, so how long, do we want people to have their own teaching experience before we ask them to teach? Right. So that's a whole different question. But often, like what I see really more often is at this point, because there are probably more people there who are at that point, is so how long do you need to have a solid regular practice before you're actually capable of teaching? Right. And that is something which we like really made a very strong point, like in our book, like A Clinician's Guide to Teaching Mindfulness, say like, you cannot teach this if you don't practice. Because you, like the teaching, it need to come from your own embodied practice. And this whole topic of embodiment is so weird for people. And I see that like all the time at the VA, right? And I'm sure you see that too, because they're like highly skilled, highly trained clinicians, right? Who have a license, who can pretty much do whatever they want. I mean, like in parameters, obviously. And I think, yeah, I mean, mindfulness is just like, how hard can that be, right? You're in the present moment. And so they're like, I sometimes hear people teach and I go like, that's not mindfulness. Right. That's what they call it, but it's actually not what it is. And I'm really proud of our national training program at the VA that we offer there. We actually have people for a year. And what we do is we don't train them as MBSR teachers, but we start them with MBSR, because I still believe that MBSR is kind of the gold standard for mindfulness training. And I really feel that that is where people really struggle with seeing it's really hard to practice for half an hour, 45 minutes, right? And when you can see that, how hard it is for you, then you become more respectful of like asking other people to do something similar, right? And then, of course, there's so much overlap also like with other training modalities, like with hypnosis and with progressive muscle relaxation, right? And IT. And I mean, there are a lot of things where there is like really interference with the clinicians, and they all like mix and jumble it together. And so to really say like, no, let's start from scratch. You start with your own practice. And once we have solidified that, then we can train you how to teach.
Yeah, that's an important point. I have a funny kind of example here with my son, and sometimes the dads volunteer and the moms volunteer to coach the kids. They haven't really played the game or know much about sports development and performance. And the things that I see, I wonder, I'm not sure the next coach, if it's a real coach that they get, is going to be happy with whatever. And are we training them incorrectly? And so they will go on to perhaps display skills that are not fundamental to being a better performer in a sport. Yeah. That's what came to mind. And so the outcome of the fear there would be like, oh, this child, when they reach the next level, may have to be re-educated and lose bad habits that dads and moms delivered. So what's like an allegory to that in the meditation world? If a person's not practicing, what might come out as an endpoint?
Yeah. What happens is like what we're of course most afraid of is that their students will go away from mindfulness and say like, I tried mindfulness and it didn't work. And that is kind of the saddest thing, right? Because they actually didn't learn mindfulness. They learned something else and that didn't work. But they will, like, because it's such a popular label now, walk away thinking it was mindfulness. But what they're learning is, and I mean, you know this, like, people want to relax, right? And people think meditation is about relaxation. And that is probably the most common thing, right? That people, and we know it's not about relaxation. I mean, if you feel relaxed, that's great, right? Being feeling relaxed definitely helps sticking with meditation, deepening meditation. So there's a lot of things to be said about relaxation, but the goal of mindfulness is actually to be present. And that often really implies that you notice just how not relaxed you are, right? And how unable you are to relax. And then when people say that, I mean, like, we have that so often in a class where people say, like, oh, that was a bad meditation. And I say, like, what do you mean? And they say, oh, I felt so tense. I mean, like, my mind was all over the place. I feel like the pain in my back, and then I can't breathe properly. And it's just like, it's like, yes, you did it just right. Because you were aware of all of that, right? And so it's really quite different. So I'm often thinking about, like, the popularity of the mindfulness apps that are out there, right? And a lot what I see is, so, like, I often feel when people only meditate like 5 or 10 minutes, and I'm not dissing that because it really works for people, but they're not really practicing mindfulness. They're often really just practicing like a quick, like, pick me up or feel good, right? Because you can hold kind of like, oh, I'm meditating, I feel my breath for a short period of time. But what we're training really is, so when we're training MBSR and you do a body scan for half an hour, 45 minutes, or any meditation for that amount of time, there is no way you feel great the entire time, every time, right? And so, and people often think like, yeah, but that, I don't want that. We say, like, no, but that is the point. What you're learning there, be bored. What does that feel like? Be restless. What does that feel like? Have all these itches. What does that feel like, right? Feeling like you're jumping out of your skin. What does that feel like? How are you relating to that? What are you doing when that is arising normally? That is the actual learning. And there's, I think, a lot of confusion around that with this, like, these, like, brief meditations and quick fixes.
I think that's a great point. I'm familiar with someone in my family who took on one of the popular apps. And I mean, he still tells me it changed his life to manage anxiety. And so I don't know exactly what that means, changing his life, but he said it changed his life listening to it 15 minutes a day. Point. So what do you think is happening then? So you said there's this deeper lesson, perhaps, and it's more of a longer term battle with recognizing discomfort and many challenges that are posed if you wait long enough. So what is that little piece to be gained that we're talking about here? It seems like there's a gap between maybe getting yourself reset by a practice that says maybe is 5 to 10 minutes and doing the deeper work, like in an MBSR program where after 45 minutes, you've seen quite a bit of what the sensory world has to tell you.
Right.
And you have to be able to roll with that, accept part of that, and continue on the very next day, perhaps, or the next week.
Yeah.
So what is there? What's that in between that's happening?
I think, so first of all, and again, I want to make that very clear. I'm not saying that, like, people can't gain a lot out of the 5 or 10 minutes. And I know for a lot of people, like, it feels like back in the day it was like either MBSR or nothing, right? I mean, that was the only thing that was out there, honestly. And that's a deep dive, right? Get people from like zero meditation to 45 minutes every day. I mean, that's a big ask, right? And there were plenty of people said, like, no, I can't do that. I can't sit with I can't be with myself for that long, right? And now, of course, we also, like, we have a lot of, like, more, like, trauma-informed teachings at this point. So we know a lot more, like, what that really does to the nervous system of a lot of people, like, how we give instruction. So that part is really important. I know a lot of people who will build on 5 or 10 minutes. I have a colleague. He's like a super high achiever lawyer, and he started with 1 minute meditation because that was all he could handle, right? And he built his way up, like a very tenacious person, built his way up to be able to sit for an hour and enjoy it, right? But that was a long and arduous kind of journey. And they're really like, hats off. I mean, there's so many ways in. So I'm not saying like there's anything bad with that. It's just like, is that, and it might be enough for a lot of people actually to stay with this. But to your question, so something, what is like, I find super fascinating. I would love to get your, if you have like an opinion on that, is so what we're really noticing. So if you look at the mindfulness questionnaires, a lot of them, what they're actually asking is not just, are you aware, but also how are you relating to something? Are you able to hold something with a little bit more spaciousness? Are you less reactive? Are you able to let go of an upsetting thought, for example, right? But if we think about that, those are actually questions about the quality of equanimity. That's not mindfulness. And if you ask people who are coming to a class and learn about mindfulness, why they come, they most of them want more peace and they want more ease and be able to be with the things as they are, the things that they can't change, and enjoy their lives more, right? But that, like, this is more ease, more peace, more balance, less reactivity. This is actually about equanimity. This is not about mindfulness. So I think like in how the way we talk about mindfulness, because of course, practicing mindfulness in the traditional way will increase equanimity, but it's not the same. Right. And so, and that is something that we're really seeing when we're starting in people on a mindfulness journey. Right. So in MBSR, what happens? Typical MBSR journey is people are all gung ho and I'll do it and it's amazing. And then they do it for a few weeks and then they go like, oh my God, I had no idea basically how bad it is, how messed up I am, how I yell at my kids and I snap at my partner. And I'm just, I mean, like, right. And what happens is, so awareness rises, equanimity doesn't yet, right? And so that's a really typical teaching point. And every teacher needs to know this, right? We're saying like out of these 8 classes in MBSR, class 4 is the hardest. Why? Right? Because people are more aware, but they don't have kind of the balm of equanimity or serenity yet, because that has a lag time. And so one thing that I really wonder for people who only do like the short meditations, like I wouldn't say it's impossible, obviously, but it's harder to really develop equanimity, right? Because equanimity is really having the capacity to hold something that is challenging with more spaciousness and less reactivity.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I believe it and other things are probably with 5 to 10 minute sessions. You don't have the time relationship that you might to say being in meditation for 20 minutes, 45 minutes. You can see how the things arise, the emotions that are a part of those things, and then how they can resolve kind of as a process on their own without having to get in the way and do a whole bunch.
Exactly.
In doing that in 5 minutes, and just like from personal practice, I agree, it's hard to get into that zone, because if you just are breathing and get relaxed enough to start attending to what's happening by sensory experience, and then the timer goes off and okay, I need to get back to work here. I'm on the same page as you, saying that, yeah, the time spent seeing the evolution of the challenge at its peak, and the resolution is the learning process, from what I can tell.
Right.
And it's the same thing in some of our work in the addictions field. Like if we were able to have our patients and clients just relax for 5 minutes, yeah, that is one thing and they may enjoy it, but they may not uncover the process of when there's something that cues them to start attending to drug-seeking behavior. right. How that becomes powerful, right. How that in some circumstances they report becomes greater than them in its power. And then seeing, they don't see the resolution. It's just like, oh, then I engaged in the behavior.
Right.
So that being an example of something very powerful emotion, craving, for a substance, if you've been addicted to that substance. Yeah, I can't imagine that 5 minutes you could see that pathway and then gain perhaps what we call wisdom at the end of that. It's like, oh, I see start to finish, how this process can yeah, unfold.
Like yeah, start to finish.
It's yeah, just start like, to finish, yeah. How it can yeah. unfold. And yeah. how did I respond in the end? And
yes.
Oftentimes they a patient or a client will come to you because they didn't respond the way they wanted to. Their intention was not to use. But perhaps what you're saying is the time allows the person to get closer and closer to what might be that optimal wellness endpoint for them. So yeah. It took me 45 minutes to see that my skin was not going to actually be ripped off of me in this pain that I'm feeling, this angst that I'm feeling. Right. So yeah, I can't imagine. I agree on both sides. Like perhaps if you did this 5 minutes, like your lawyer friend, 1 minute, 5 minutes, often it's been suggested that it, as long as you're making transition towards longer amounts of time and commitment, perhaps that is the benefit, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like the gateway to considering wellness more holistically in one's life.
Yeah.
Versus what you're getting at, and maybe was your trajectory, I can jump all the way into the deep end, do mindfulness-based stress reduction like programs for 45 minutes daily. Mm-hmm. And that probably is a disposition, right? That some people hold early. You probably had some special qualities that would make you different than many of us.
Yeah, you know, like what we often say is like, you need the gift of desperation, right? Because, I mean, people like, it feels like I often have to argue or kind of, I mean, I'm not fighting with folks anymore. It's just, they don't want to do the practice. They don't want to do the practice, right? I'm not the mindfulness police, but they bargain with me. So like, can I get away with 20 minutes? How about 15 minutes? Right. And it's just like, why do you need my permission? Right. So that's an interesting thing right there. Right. And it's really, I mean, I sometimes ask people, like, if your life would depend on this, if you knew you could make your illness go away by finding 45 minutes a day, would you find 45 minutes a day? People go, of course, right? So then I say, like, okay, then please don't argue with me that you don't have the time. Right. I mean, it's like, maybe it's a little bit too harsh, but it's like people want to do like more and more and more and more, right? They want to do this and then they want to meditate and they want to have all these things, right? That they've learned this is good for them. And we only have a limited amount of time. So, and then this is something that we actually say at the beginning of an MBSR class, you might need to stop doing something else for the time of the course. What are you willing to not do, right? And people go like, what do you mean? Because that feels like I'm taking something away. But I'm saying like, no. You need to make space to bring something in that you really want, right? Instead of just trying to cram in more and more.
This is a really good point. It reminds me of some emotions I was having yesterday. I wanted to run all day. You know, I have a little one at home. The schooling right now is very challenging. They keep closing and opening schools with all that's going on with COVID. So never know who's going to be watching my son. And I was like, I've been sitting so much. I need to run. I need to run. It is like becoming pain, mental pain. I need to run. I need to be doing this. Made it all the way to the end of the night. And I had a laundry list of things to do. And my son was on his way back home. And I felt that interval closing in on me. Uh-oh. No time. And just feeling the angst and the pain. And then actually, right when I was about to do it, I just did a quick check-in, little body scan of where I was, and was like, I'm already pretty sore. I was running around, lifting boxes.
Oh, wow.
And So sometimes, you know, not a deep meditation, but if you have seen the arising of like desires of pain or any of these things, and then I'm realizing all day that was on me.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, not even having to do it. So it's like the not doing in a way you were just talking about. Like,
nice.
Oh, I don't actually need to do this. My body is telling me it's already tired.
Beautiful.
Am I doing more harm? If I go run right now with the 20 minutes I have, I'm going to come home and maybe it's not great for me. So,
Right. Yeah, that's such a good point.
And I didn't do anything. And, maybe it felt kind of good in that moment. I was like, let go of this. That's fine. So not doing people. I can imagine you've seen so many individuals interested to become teachers, and you've seen all of your students. And it seems like sometimes you're saying, you know, you don't need to do everything. And maybe that in itself is a form of striving. So is there something to be said about people who really want to do something with mindfulness, but you might have cases where you're like, you know, maybe this isn't the best for now, or other teachings that have arisen from that.
No, I see that often, honestly, right? So like really sit with your motivation of why do you need to teach this and why do you need to do this now? And in particular with people who don't really have a very solid practice yet. So I would often recommend this, like, why don't you practice for another year, right? And really use the time that you would be using for a teacher training. Use that for practice. Go on retreats, right? Make sure you have a solid practice, or you practice twice a day or something, right? If you can, and see if something changes. And to the point where I've really had people go like, wow, I had no idea like how attached I was to this, the kind of the identity of a teacher, right? And how hard that was, like not to feel like I'm go like the straight path to that, right? But it felt like, oh, having to practice more is like a detour a little bit, right? And often it has something to do with like self-value, or they come face to face with their relationship to patients, right? Or what they feel like is a waste of time. I mean, it's just very, very interesting what comes up.
Is there, for those who might not understand our program, you have so much experience with that. Could you give us the light overview of the sessions and kind of the main points of those sessions, and kind of what's the expectation for practice and stuff by the end? So it's like a program description light.
For MBSR?
Yes, please.
Yeah. So in MBSR, I mean, in a way I keep falling back in love with MBSR the deeper I go into it. And I think it was such a, honestly, stroke of genius of Jon Kabat-Zinn when he put this together. I mean, just the fact that MBSR starts with a body scan, right? Then this is, of course, so MBSR is an 8-week class, and it's like 2.5 hours every week. And it has a full practice day of like 7 hours on a weekend, like between class 5 and 6 or 6 and 7. And that's a lot of time spent in class, and people go like, what are we doing? And we go like, well, we practice. We actually practice together, right? And then people practice at home, and really people need to practice at home. And it's not about perfection, but it's really like all the things that we just talked about. And so we start with the body. And what's really interesting, because actually the MBSR class is mapped on the 4 foundations of mindfulness, or the Satipatthana Sutta, which is like one of the core teachings of the Theravada or insight meditation tradition. And the first foundation that the Buddha taught is the body. Like, why the body? Because the body is always in the present moment. And we are so disembodied as a culture. We so value anything mind analytical over anything that goes in the body. And then on the other hand, we're obsessed with the body, but not in a good way. We're obsessed with looks or with performance, not with function. When we really think about it, what the body was made, how evolution shaped the body. It's about function. It has nothing to do with looks or peak performance. I mean, like high performance, athletic performance, right? Or how muscles look, which, I mean, that's another thing like that we're just obsessed with. It's about function. And people forget that. We really forget that. And then we hate our bodies. And we don't pay attention to our bodies unless something goes wrong, right? And then we're like in deep conflict with the body. So to start with a body scan is really just like what we're doing in a body scan is we pay attention to every part of the body and just noticing what is there. We don't ask anything. We don't want anything, right? Sometimes, or very often actually, we feel nothing. Just like, oh, yeah, I can't really feel my lower leg right now, right? So body scan. So that's the first. Actually, it goes like through the first three classes. And then it starts to break up a little bit. And a lot of people, because so many people have meditated before, they go like, I don't want to do the body scan. Most people actually don't like the body scan because it's right. It just brings us up front with like our conflicts with the body and how hard it is to be embodied. But that's exactly the practice, right? So we do body scans. And then in week three, we are starting with mindful yoga, mindful movement. Right. And so again, like it's body practice, it's noticing what happens in the body and like striving, right? Is it easier for me to be present when the body moves or when the body is still? What's coming up, right? And actually being able to feel the body more after I have done mindful movement. So doing that and then bringing that in, starting a little bit with mindfulness of breath meditation. And then we're starting to also weave in the second foundation of mindfulness, which is noticing pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, right? And so there are exercises around that. And what we do is just we become aware that all of our experience is either one of those three, right? It's either pleasant, either unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And then how are we habitually reacting to that, right? We don't want the unpleasant. We want to hold on to the pleasant and we check out about the neutral. So interesting, right? And if we can create more space around that and say like, I don't need to do that again, like what we were talking about earlier, like the arising and passing away, right? The beginning, the middle, and the end, noticing that. And so that is like kind of half of through the MBSR class. And then only really like in the middle of the class, we start with really focusing on stress, stress education. What is stress? Like what are people bringing, right? And then seeing really in their own experience, why they do the meditations or while they are like in everyday life, they see how they are reacting, right? So we call that a stress reaction. Right. So somebody says something to you and you have already snapped. Right. And there was no decision. Right. You didn't decide as like, oh, I'll snap at my wife now. Right. It's just like, bam, there's no gap between the impulse arising. Right. And our reaction. And we see how often that we get into trouble through that. Right. And as we said earlier, and often actually we start to see it more clearly. Oh, this is a pattern and I can't change it yet. Right. And so that's like kind of the peak, you could say, of the class, like class four, class five. And then
because that's an important part of what is being taught in MBSR. And we all know in our practice, when you recognize things in yourself, which you can judge. So we can judge ourselves for being reactive to a spouse. For example.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
And there's pain in that.
I hope that we are.
We're supposed to be. Yeah, we can. So we can. So that's one of the cognitive mechanisms, right?
Yes.
Or we can observe what we did from non-judgment, because supposedly that doesn't help us really. I mean,
no, it doesn't.
We can debate about that, whether, you know, if we are judges of ourselves, maybe it does stop us from doing it in the future, but that's not the purpose of this practice.
No.
So there is this discomfort, because I think this is an important turning point.
Yes, it is.
The recognition in yourself that there are issues you don't like.
Yeah.
Some folks, is there a point here where it's hard for some folks, because then there's the need for acceptance, and it can be very uncomfortable with, I see clearly now what my behaviors are, the way I think about the world, the way I'm seeing things, the way this feels. And I just want to turn back into the darkness on this one, because
absolutely.
So what do you see happening there, and what's important for people to get past that?
Yeah, what's really important is to know that this is the arch, that this is the progression, right? So like we have this, and I still don't really know like where that came from. Maybe you do know this, like this, like the four steps of progression. So we're moving from like unconscious incompetence. Do you know that one? Unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence, to conscious competence, to unconscious competence, right? And nobody wants to be in the place of conscious incompetence, right? And I love that. It's just like, and we have a poem, like the Portia Nelson poem, like the autobiography in 5 chapters, awesome poem. And it's just like, let's not take ourselves so seriously, honestly. So we joke about it, say like, yep, here we are. And we're just right on track. And it feels icky. And this is really one thing, like why I believe like MBSR doesn't work really well in when you just do it one-on-one. So I've done that a number of times. It rarely ever really lands. So there's something really powerful in doing it in a group. And people go like, yeah, me too, right? And just that, like the shared humanity, right? Yeah, we all see more clearly now, and it sucks. Like we don't want to be here. And it's just like, ugh, really, right? And to say like, yeah, that's normal. This is just like, this is how we move through this, right? Because we can only change what we can see. Right. If you are not even aware that you're doing it because you think it's actually your wife's problem because she's triggering you, right? It's not, has nothing to do with you, right? Then nothing will change. So that at that point really, really helps people.
Very good. Okay. And then moving forward, we're in session 4. Many people are having realizations here that there's some problems with them, and we're all human, and yeah. What are we going to do about it? I mean, can we pull ourselves up from our bootstraps in a way? Or do we let go? What's the process?
Yeah. So what happens is at that point, there's some people will come back and say like, wow, I caught myself, right? And they have like really like this aha moments, and that inspires the rest of the group. And because we have so many small moments during the day, so we have so many chances to practice. So it's really, it's just a matter of time that more often you go like, oh, now I caught myself. Right. And I'm also saying like, look, before you didn't even notice you did it again, right? Until like 2 days later. Right. And now what you're doing is you notice while it happens. That's fantastic. Right. So you see how awareness just like comes closer and closer to the moment of reaction. And then hopefully at that time point, right, with having done like all these long, boring body scans and long meditations, you've had many opportunities to watch an itch start, peak, go away. Right? A thought bother you, and then you forget about it, right? An emotion just like churning, and then disappearing. So you at that point, you really have a lot of these practices under your belt of awareness, of more spaciousness around, of noticing impulses arising. And then, so we're basically, it's kind of like, you know, like the, like from the, gosh, what's that movie? Like the wax on, wax off.
The Karate Kid,
right? So like what you do is you've practiced your moves, right? Every time you can say to your thought, thank you, not now, not going there, right? That's that you practice your moves. Every time you're not scratching itch, you practice your moves. And so, and that will spill over, right? And then you will at some point find yourself in a situation, just to stay with that kind of example, with your wife, like you feel triggered and you're about to snap and you notice like, oh, I feel like I want to say this and I don't. And then you go like, yay. Right. And then you know, and of course not every time, right? And then some things feel bigger, and this is really where the self-compassion comes in, right? We don't have to be perfect. We make mistakes, we stumble, pick ourselves up, and that's just not a problem. Yeah.
So I'll add to your example with you know, parenting a three-year-old during a pandemic, which I'm glad I had a practice and I had some of the basics in this practice. And something I had to learn, and that practice was useful for, to see the arising of strong emotions, especially when it's purely physiological, like a child screaming.
Yeah,
it just physically kind of hurts.
It does.
And it does. To acknowledge, oh, my body is in pain right now, whatever is going on in my brain, this hurts it.
Yes.
And this is a sensitive and vulnerable moment. So yes. Recognize that things could go south.
Yeah.
And the hardest part, and I think over time, what I realized was, how can I maintain all of this and also see what is being requested by my toddler? Because the most important way out of it was directly through their needs. So
yes. Yes.
Even if they wanted to do something that wasn't great in the moment,
right.
It was finding something, like the solution being a distraction. And it's often right. Just showing them something else.
Yeah.
And it was just keeping my physiology cool enough
yes.
To keep those higher order thoughts in line to be able to plan, right? Because that's yes. The hardest thing. Yes. We lose our planning. And I could feel, I could watch it
yes.
And observe like it and seeing it slipping rising, away. Right? Yeah. And I'd be like, there it goes. There. I can't think of anything to do right now. That was the worst yeah. Moment. Like yeah. Just blank. I can't pull anything to mind about how to manage this meltdown
yeah.
And trying to just wait. Okay, wait, there's going to be something that comes.
Right. Good,
oh
good.
Yeah. He yeah. Likes that toy.
Yeah.
Let me redirect. And of course right. It doesn't always work, but I can imagine, you know, if parents may not have that fundamental yes. Or
oh, yeah.
Practice to just constantly be in a battle because yes. You can't see that you're losing your abilities, right?
Yeah,
you're just
exactly.
Physiologically yeah. Losing some abilities.
Yeah, you do. And then you feel terrible afterwards, right?
And yeah, and then you feel much worse because you yeah. Did the thing you kept yeah. Promising yourself. Okay, I wasn't going to discipline in that way, or
yeah.
I wasn't going to yell at them, or yeah, right. I wanted a solution to make right. Them grow. And,
right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so spousal work and parent work, it's all hard work when we it actually is. Observe it in real time.
It is. But it's so worth it, don't you think? I mean, just like with your example, because you had that capacity, right? And I'm sure you did that too, but like with my friends and colleagues who are practitioners, we just like basically throughout the entire pandemic, we're repeating saying like, thank goodness for practice. Thank goodness for practice. Right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, these could be part of practice or broader psychological maturity elements, shifting expectations. I think this is what the pandemic has helped a lot with in understanding if we've been paying attention
yeah.
And especially practice during a pandemic is the expectations that things are going to work out well.
Yeah.
Have been recalibrated.
Oh,
so.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. First day of school, my wife and I were like, you know, it's been 3 months. Every day we've had to figure out a new plan. Every day is a new plan. And finally, here we go. We're going to get this entry into the Golden Gates and get our son back in preschool. We get an email 3 p.m. that day. We're going to delay. Things aren't looking good with the test. So, you know, and just feeling in my heart, oh, yeah. I expected that, you know, yeah. There's a, yeah. That acceptance is a yeah. Huge piece. And yes. When do you see that landing in the MBSR course, like the real acceptance of the big challenges?
Yeah, I think it keeps landing like long after MBSR is over, right? And it doesn't always land, of course, right? I mean, people come from such different walks of life. But very often, so like what we're also doing, so in class 5, we introduce a practice that's called choiceless awareness, So before that, we have like upped the amount of mindfulness of breathing for those for whom that is a good anchor, which is a more focused practice, right? And then the choiceless awareness is really using our very deliberately our capacity to have mindfulness either be very focused, right? We can just focus on like a very small detail, or widening it. This is like, I often use like this image, like when you're like, let's say like the more focused attention is like you're in a garden and you just look at one plant or even just like one flower or one leaf and you see every detail, right? And you see every flaw, right? Which is, I mean, that's like really where we come into like the pain or like what doesn't work well. And then what we do is we deliberately like start, like basically step back and take in the whole garden. And when we do this, we suddenly see like, oh, there's a whole garden here, like with a lot of plants, right? And a lot of life. And some plants are sick, some plants are dying, right? But most plants are actually healthy and thriving. And so the one sickly plant that I might have focused on before, right, just has a different weight in the whole picture. And that is really, and right, so because the mind has the tendency to hyper-focus on what's not working, like we, the negativity bias, we call that, right? And especially when we have pain, physical pain or emotional pain, like kind of the awareness collapses around that, right? And it feels like there's nothing else left, right? People who have ever had like a like pain in the body know that. It feels like you're just that painful shoulder, right? And you forget that the rest of the body is actually not in pain. And so that is really part of the pain practice. And of course, like what that was like creating MBSR, one of the reasons why Jon Kabat-Zinn did that was for people with chronic pain and illness. Like all the people that had ever heard from their doctors or care providers, it's like, well, you have to learn how to live with that. And then sent out the door without any instructions how to learn that, right? And so it was just picking up like really a big need, right? And so that's the choiceless awareness. So that's class five. And then what we also do at that point is we introduce loving kindness practice. So that's a big controversy around like the, we have like these different schools that say, compassion or kindness needs to be taught or it needs to be caught by the teacher. So, right. So some people say like, well, as the teacher, you have to embody compassion and kindness. And by your embodiment, your students will pick that up. And then there are like other people who say like, no, no, this is so hard for folks. And we're so trained to understand and implement concepts from the top down, from the head down, that we have to explain that, right? So we do a little bit of loving kindness, but not really. But it's it's enough that there are, I mean, really regularly people saying like, oh, the loving kindness, that really change things, right? Because like sometimes when there is no kindness, there can be like a harshness together with the mindfulness. It's just like, see what you're doing, see what you're doing, you look at this, right? So that's not what we want when we practice like awareness. So that's kind of the arch of the MBSR class.
I see that there's something that I feel familiar with what you're talking about here. Maybe you can help me line it up with what the different practices have helped me with here. So my wife and I had a lot of tragedies in this last year with death of parents, some of our parents, some of our grandparents in isolation, delayed ceremonies, cancer diagnoses for our family, and some other terrible things. And it's, you know, with the background of the pandemic, it just makes everything seem that much worse.
Yes.
And as I'm, you know, we've worked through these things together and I'm on my walk with my dog yesterday and I'm looking up at the mountains and just overwhelmed with beauty, just, but at the same time of thinking about those, like tragedy and it's in my heart and I feel the weight and then saying to myself, why is there still so much beauty and feeling that beauty? And there's the moment there where I could like jump on myself, right? Because there was a couple thinking patterns that I observed and was like, oh, I can go in the direction of, you shouldn't feel good that the world is still right. so beautiful
right.
because of all of this loss. And you can go the direction of, you know, the world is still beautiful despite of loss.
Yes.
But both of those are still judgments, and I can just be conscious here of beauty and not judge either of those directions. What do you think was happening, you know, in having a practice? Could that phenomenon just appear? I'm sure we're all humans and it could come up.
Yeah.
Is there any practices that aid that type of realization? Because feeling okay with all the tragedy that has happened and then seeing beauty seemed revelatory to me, a little shocking.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That actually goes very deep into kind of really like, I think, the meaning of life and how we make sense of what's happening in the world and how we get through things, right? And there are a lot of actually beautiful poetry written exactly around what you experienced, right? It's just like this being baffled with how can things be so ripping your heart out and so breathtakingly beautiful at the same time. Right. And what happens, I think, in that moment is this, and it just, we have to let go. We have to let go of our small sense of self and our concept of what's right and how things have to be. And we can just really, and sometimes people express that really as like a really spiritual moment. It's just like, oh, this is so much bigger than I, right? And a sense of surrender into something. I don't understand how this all makes sense, but like just like a trusting a little bit, like falling back into something that is bigger than we are. And I think when we have these moments that can be deeply nourishing and deeply rebalancing and can give us really the strength to then like go back into the pain, right? I think, I mean, it's just like, I mean, in the Buddhist mythology, in our Tibetan Buddhist mythology, there are these teaching of the six realms, right? And the out of the realm, so there's the God realm, like where everything is perfect. And then there's the hell realm where everything is terrible. And there's the animal realm, right? And so like, and then, when you're in the God realm, you're not learning because everything is perfect, right? So there's no motivation to change, to go deeper, to dig deeper, to find out what is this all about. If you live in the hell realm on the other side, it's too desperate, right? So why bother? I mean, you just want to be numb and be over with, right? And then, but then the teachings is that only in the human realm, you can gain enlightenment. And why is that? Because you have the perfect mixture between beauty and pain. And we need that, right? We need the beauty. We need the joy, the connection, the love in order to keep going. But we also need the pain or we won't move forward or deeper or, I know I use like, the words of like the industrial revolution. That's just the vocabulary that we have for that, right? Does that make sense?
It does. And thank you for that. And you've brought this work to some very important places. So with MBSR, this project with the Department of Veterans Affairs, it seems like this is a key locale where people have suffered with pain and other stressors. What is the program like there, and you know, why is it being used?
So we started this program actually as like a small project. We got a grant, so Inside LA, and I was part of that here in LA for the local VA here. And the idea was just cultural transformation, because the VA is known to be not such a friendly and compassionate place. And that was one thing. And the other was that the veterans were asking for it. right? They say, like, we don't want any more pills. We don't want any more procedures. We don't want to be managed. We want, again, like, agency is so important. It's just like, you are the only person who can heal yourself, right? I can't heal you. I might be able, as a physician, I might be able to fix, like, your broken leg, right? I can't heal you. Your body is doing that. You're doing that yourself. And how do we give this, like, the power back to the person, right? And there's something very powerful about that. So there was a need for that. And then we started, and together, so with Greg Serper, who was a psychologist at the VA. So we started that, like, I think about like 10 years ago, maybe. And then from there, so we started, first we started teaching MBSR and teaching actually also like mindful self-compassion, which is another really important program. And then we started to train clinicians, right? Because we were thinking, is that there are only that many classes that we can teach. So we need to start to spread this. And then we had like two local trainings here. And then we got invited actually by the National Office of Patient-Centered Care and Cultural Transformation. They said like the whole VA needs this. And they really had the vision to say like, let's start. And we started with that like a couple of years ago with the first national training. And we started with 18 flagships at the VA. So there were particular flagships all around America where there were hospitals that had gotten extra funding for these kind of modalities, like alternative healing modalities. And we started with that. And the people, what was so interesting, David, it's just like, I smile at this is because we still see this. And we just did applications for a new round. And so we have like 170 slots and we had like almost 600 applicants. Because people just say like, this is the best training that we've ever done at the VA. And it's just like, and it's not that I think like we necessarily were so like outrageously amazing, but what people learn is transformative. And here's the thing, here's a funny thing. So why do you think people come to the training, most of them?
Probably they see the stress in MBSR component and they want to manage stress.
They come because they want to teach their patients. At the VA, the clinicians come. This is training for clinicians. They come because they want to share this with their patients. They don't come for themselves. So, and what do we make them do? Like, as I shared earlier, what we first make them do is just like, you need to learn this. You can only share that with your patients once you've had that under your belt. And they go like, oh, okay. But that is the kind of the irony, the sad irony of just like, they would not come if it was a self-care program, right? Because they, I mean, like that is so in healthcare and in particular in the VA, it's just like they do anything for their patients. And they have this mindset, and you know that mindset from many clinicians that's saying, like, what do I have to complain about? Right? When I sit across from a young guy who has lost both legs in the war, right? What do I have to complain, and who suffers from PTSD, right? I'm not important. They are. But what we do is, so we make them practice. And what they say, they start to see is like, wow, I had no idea how much I needed that, right? I notice my relationship to my partner is better. My relationship to my colleagues is better. I feel better, right? I'm actually able to listen to my patients again. While before that, I was just managing them because I was so stressed out. And so like, we're joking, it's a little bit like a Trojan horse, right? So we think like, no, we teach you to deliver this, right? And then we go just like, no, I'm sorry, you need to be able to meditate yourself. And then you really benefit from that. And I just love that.
So you are training staff that are already part of the VA system.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. And do you follow these trainees and see what the ultimate path towards delivery is? So are they, do they ultimately, after the whole training program and with confirmation that they can do this, Are they spreading this practice across the VA?
Yeah. So like our, like one of our requirements for the applications is that they have supervisor permission to teach at least 2 hours per week, and they have to be full-time employees. And then, but the question, of course, that's like the scientist in me, like knows that that's a really juicy question to see, like how many people are. So how, like, what's the ripple effect? How many people do we reach? We don't have numbers for that yet. But what we did is actually, so the first national rollout, we had a research team follow our group of people, right? Just to see like, so what is changing? And like, is there, we use the Rebecca Crane competency. So the MBI tech for just, which is really interesting. And as a self measure, and some of like we observed the people teach. And yeah, and it's so we have some data on the program itself, but not yet on the reach. Yeah. And so, what we're, and also like what we're training people to do. So again, like there's a lot of confusion around that. It's not an MBSR teacher training, but it is, we train them to deliver a, so in, as part of our book, which actually came out of our work at the VA, because people kept asking like, do you have that written down somewhere? So the Clinician's Guide to Teaching Mindfulness has a 6-week plus 2 extra sessions on self-compassion, like a curriculum in there. And we teach people to deliver that either as a 6-week class or 6-week plus 2, or as standalone modalities, right? Because a lot of clinicians, they have groups. And so they love to, let's say, open their process groups, whatever, with like a short meditation.
And so does this link to your recent book? So you said that your one of your books, at least, was a demand side book, which is, those are great because you know people already want them. And then you went, your recent book, Outsmart Your Pain, has focused on chronic pain. Now, yes. Was this a lesson learned from the VA, or is this broader, just seeing the need for what's going on in the world right now?
Yeah, interesting question. It was a combination of both, honestly. So one thing was, so because I am a physician, so I'm like, have always been like intimately aware of suffering and intimately involved in wanting to relieve suffering in whatever way I possibly can. And so I started quite early, once I started teaching MBSR for people with chronic pain and illness. And I did that for a number of years, and then I kind of got away from it. But it was really quite amazing how much people would change and how much people could really apply the practices in all different areas of like how they manage their illness or their pain. And then, so over the last few years, and originally what I actually had in mind was coming through like the VA training and seeing how, I mean, like pretty much everybody at the VA has chronic pain. Every veteran has some form of chronic pain. I mean, I might be exaggerating a little bit, but not really. So that means every clinician has to work with people with chronic pain, right? And knowing how helpful that is, and knowing like, this is not rocket science, like this is what you do. And so my original intention was actually to create a pamphlet for physicians and clinicians that they have on their desk. And if they see a patient, they say like, you're interested in mindfulness? Have you heard of that? Start here, right? Just something very simple, very straightforward, that so the doctors don't have time to explain anything, right? But they want to maybe open a door. And if you get a recommendation from your doctor to look into something, people pay attention. So that was my original intention. And then out of that grew is like, yeah, but it would be nice to actually create something that both mindfulness teachers, clinicians and patients can use. And so the book is actually, it's like, it's not a lot to read. So it has 20 short chapters on different aspects that come up around pain and how people can work with that. And every chapter has a guided practice. And that guided practice is also, I've recorded those meditations on my website. So when people get the book, they can also listen to my voice guiding them through it. So that was, like, in my mind, the most practical, clearest way to deliver these teachings.
In my reading of the book, I saw, at least I personally saw, a premise in the equation that you set up early on. You indicate suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance.
Yeah.
And that seemed to set the stage. I got it. do you want to just speak to that as the entire premise? Because I did see it, like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. And then viewing all the chapters, like, oh, this is the solution to that equation.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I didn't come up with that, as I think Shinzen Young did, but I totally fell in love with that. That just made so much sense to me. Right. So sometimes we have the saying, like, or you have heard that, is like pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. And I always felt that is so dismissive, honestly. I always had a reaction towards that saying. If you've ever worked with people or had, like, chronic pain yourself, it's just, you just want to jump into a person's face who says that. But this is, if we're just breaking it down, saying, like, okay, so usually we equate pain and suffering, right? But they're two different things, right? And so we say, well, pain is a constant. It can be physical pain, can be emotional pain, right? So it's a constant. But then, in your own experience, notice that the more you're resisting this pain that is already here, or the more you worry about it, right? Is your suffering going up? Is that your lived experience? And I haven't met a person yet, I believe, who doesn't go, like, yeah, sure. If I hate what's happening to me, it gets worse. And it's like, all right. So if we can do something about the pain, we will, right? But what we definitely can work with is the resistance and the worry, right? And that is such great news, right? Because if pain really is a constant in life, right, we can still work on the suffering. And I sometimes even, like, push people a little bit further, because, so just if you look at it as a mathematical equation, so pain is a constant, right? And resistance is zero. What happens to suffering? It's zero. And then people go, like, wait, what? I think I just got tricked. And then we explore in the class, it's just, have you ever had pain and there wasn't suffering? Right? And then people can always come up with examples. It's just like we started out just talking about long distance running. I know pain without suffering in long distance running. It's just like, yeah, that's there and it's okay. I know it's not dangerous, right? And it's okay. Or people will say, like, during childbirth, right? Or people get a tattoo. It's just like, that hurts, but there's no suffering. So it's like, and then people go, like, wait, what is pain? And I always think, like, when I get people to think about something and question their beliefs, then I've done a good job. I don't have answers for people. But if they go home and go, like, what just happened? Like, I have to really, like, something just blew my mind, literally, right? And then, like, there's an opening and maybe really some new possibility.
I've investigated pain in my own life quite a bit. I played a lot of sports, and not the best ones, contact sports and football, and ran hurdles. And there are a lot of strange injuries that occurred to the joints. And for these last 2 years, there's what I would probably call chronic shoulder pain.
Mm.
And it is a matter of constantly going through the cycle and having to recognize early enough, waking up in the night or trying to get to sleep, how much of this night am I going to allow to be eaten up by what's going on in my head too?
Beautiful.
Because I'm not going to sleep very well if I keep telling myself
right.
that it shouldn't happen Pain should not be happening to me when I'm sleeping. You know, aging should not be like this. And I could go into all types of stories for how much of a tragedy this mm-hmm. pain in my shoulder should be. Yeah. And on the nights, it's very interesting. On the nights where I just let it go and whatever challenges arise, the next day it is much better, much less pain than if I battle that all night, because it's almost as if you go into a battle with your own body.
Is. You do.
And you don't, you don't often win that battle.
No. And that is just a beautiful description of really the physiology that is happening, right? So the whole, like the stress cascade in our body makes pain worse, right? And so anything we can do to either reduce the stress cascade or to reduce just what gets us into, which is a lot, really, it's worrying. It's worried. So it's like, that's what the mind does. It rehashes or it rehearses, right? So I call that in the book, like the past pain story, like why you shouldn't be having this, right? Why this should be over. Like, why were you so stupid and did that contact? I mean, like whatever the head is, right? That's past pain story. And it makes you feel a particular way right now in the middle of the night, right? Not what happened like 10 years ago or something, right? And then the mind goes into the future pain story. It goes like, oh my God, if I can't go back to sleep right now, I'm toast tomorrow. And I have that really important presentation, right? And they will all laugh at me and I will, might not get tenure. I mean, like whatever the mind, right, is going into. And we're feeling that. It's like 2 a.m. in the morning, right? And we're like a tight, knotted stress ball. And so that coming back to mindfulness is just like, can you notice that? Can you say, thank you, not now. Thank you, not now. And just stay with what is, stay in the body and really get out of your head. And just really, I'm so glad that you know how to do that, which I think is really a result of your practice.
Some days better than others. And you do have, I mean, sometimes totally frustrated with myself, like, you know, this should not be happening. You need to take care of yourself, do better. But, you know, I don't know here if I is. Know the best way to resolve it.
Here it is.
You do have there's a lot of gems in here. Some things that stood out for me, and I don't want to cover everything. We'll let the readers do that. Maybe we'll focus on just the numbing out piece. I found that interesting. So what do you mean by numbing out and how can a mindfulness practice aid with that?
Yeah. So numbing out is just a very natural response to pain. So numbing, there are like many ways. So it's like earlier we started talking about addiction. Addiction is, in my playbook, actually a numbing out and a getting away from the pain in whatever way. Distraction is a really big one. What are we distracting ourselves with? I think it is a form of numbing out as well, right? And I don't think that numbing out or distracting ourselves is bad per se. It's just like, how are we doing it? How aware are we of doing it? What are the consequences of doing it? Right. And so that is really something where like mindfulness and kindness, that's really important here, because there's so much shame associated with addictive behavior of any kind. Right. And like societal shame and then family shame, shame inside of us. So then we don't want to look at it, right? And so mindfulness really can, and kindness can help us see, oh, this is what I'm doing. And these are the consequences of this. So what I'm saying is like, we can use, we want to have more tools in our toolbox so that numbing out is not the only option that we have, right? But it's kind of like, oh, I can always do this, but I might not need to do this right now, right? Because the more awareness I have and the more kindness comes with that is I really see the consequences of that, right? And what also really happens with the numbing out is I hear that a lot is like when we're numbing out, we're not feeling anything. Right. And what I think what we really yearn the most is to feel alive and connected. And so when we're numbing out, right, is a really like kind of really healthy responds to pain or first response to pain is we're also numbing out feeling alive and feeling like coming back to that moment of beauty that you described earlier. Like we can't feel that anymore when we're numbed out. We don't see that anymore, right? And then we're just moving more and more into this like arid, desolate place inside, right? And we know that there's a lot of overlap with chronic pain and depression. So they often roll together, right? And so how do we learn to just again like this, doing this open up practice? Say like, Ian, is there something else?
And in this deep dive in your book, any personal new realizations for you and your practice? It seems like when people set on the path of writing a book, they make a huge commitment and then there's the uncovering of something unsuspected sometime. Anything like that happened for you?
Yeah, I mean, what really happened for me is because it just keeps bringing me back to the body and body awareness. And I really feel that like over this last year, I've gained like another depth or level of depth of body awareness, of aliveness in the body. And I think it's just like a process that we're in, but then when we're just paying more and more attention. And what I really also notice, and this is also a topic that I've been like being aware of or working with for quite some years, but it's like more in the forefront, is this. So we're so focused on getting away from the negative, right? Then we don't really pay attention too much to joy and pleasure. And what I really notice is that there is a fear of pleasure, right? There is something, a fear of pleasure, or like sometimes I'm even joking. So when was the last time you experienced ecstasy? And people go like, ugh. So it's just like, don't look at me, right? Don't ask me that. And they go, I've never experienced ecstasy, right? And yet that is like part of our full, the spectrum of feeling alive. So why are we not experiencing that? Why are we not familiar with it? Most of us, I mean, like, of course, some people do, but so because there is like, just as we're afraid of pain and want to get away of it, there's something we have, if many of us have so deeply ingrained a fear of pleasure, right? And we can, just as we're being aware with pain and notice like the rising and falling of pain, we can do the same thing with something that feels pleasurable, like getting really close, right? And that can be in all of our senses. And of course, it can also be really in the sensual realm, right? So like, where are we closing down? Where are we holding back? And I think that is just like, because it's really like, if we're asking the question for me, it's like, what does really feeling fully alive feel like? Right. And I think I still have so much more to learn about that, but I'm really surprised of the level of really vibrancy that is growing within me, right? That even like years ago, like some, like a couple of years ago, I had no idea was even there. Being like, wow, I thought it was pretty good before. This is even better. And then, of course, being a teacher, thinking like, how can I teach people this so that more people can experience that, right?
Yeah, that's wonderfully put. It's resonating with me that a feeling like that that comes to me when I'm feeling strong around my child. So the fact, you know, you say, what's still right with you? And I do recognize that I'm still strong enough to do physical things with my son. Like when I throw him up in the air, we're playing in the pool. Yeah. I try to remember, this feels great. You're still able, beautiful. Like the pain in your shoulder.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah. The pain in your shoulder is still there, but you feel strong, and that probably won't be here forever. So let's really enjoy that. as he still thinks you're pretty cool and pretty strong, it probably won't last forever, but yeah, those are the things I like to try to focus in on. So this is wonderful. And where can people find you and your recent book online?
I mean, the book, so Outsmart Your Pain, it's, you can get that at every bookseller. Like Amazon has it, but you can order it through like your local bookseller for sure. I also actually recorded an audiobook version. So I've heard from some people that they, actually people with really high levels of pain, that they can't read books, but they can listen to books. And so that's out there too. That's on Audible. And my website, so my name, www.christianawolf.com. So for schedule and updates and yeah, all the things. And then also, I keep forgetting that I'm also, I love Instagram and I'm also on Facebook. So if people want to connect there, they can also do that there.
Thank you. Let's conclude for today. Thank you, Dr. Wolf. Our listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org. That's goamra.org, where you can support us by becoming a subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.